Stress seems to be the description of our generation. Lots of surveys recently taken, some of them indicating that 80% of Americans feel stress that is job-related. Physicians that say that 75% of all illness is somehow stress-related. And sociologists that are saying that stress in society is increasingly coming out in the home, in the family, that our families are becoming the victims of the stress that is so everywhere obvious. Now, of course, stress by itself is not a bad thing. And the only way to completely avoid stress is to avoid all people and to avoid all circumstances and simply not to relate to life. In fact, technically, you have to have stress to be alive. So stress is an essential commodity in the living of life. Social scientists, though, have distinguished between good stress, ou stress, or bad stress, which is called distress. The good stress comes when you get a promotion at work, or when something wonderful happens, or maybe when you win a contest and a prize. Whereas bad stress, distress, comes when you get fired at work, or when something bad happens, or when you lose the contest. Whether it's either kind, stress can take a heavy toll on our bodies and on our relationships because it tends to wear us out. And particularly in families, it pushes our relationships to the limits, causes us often to live on the edge and often to overreact. Now, our purpose tonight is not to talk about stress that is job-related or stress that is individual, but specifically to talk about stress as it relates to the crises of the family, the relationships of our homes and of our marriages and of our families together. Dolores Curran is a nationally known author and columnist and educator who has written extensively on the topic of family stress. She defines family stress very simply as a condition that arises when family life gets out of control. And she gives some symptoms that she says are typical of constantly stressful families. Listen to them. One, a constant sense of urgency and hurry. No time to release or to relax. Two, tension that underlies and causes sharp words, sibling fighting, and misunderstanding. Three, a mania to escape to one's room, to the car, to the garage, away, anywhere. Four, feeling that time is passing too quickly, that children are growing up too fast. Five, a nagging desire for a simpler life and constant talk about times that were or will be simpler. Six, no time for memories. Seven, little me time or little couple time. And finally, a pervasive sense of guilt for not being and doing everything to and for all the people in our family and church and neighborhood. Now, she goes on to explain that she thinks there are essentially three causes for this kind of family stress in our society and in our generation. She begins by talking about cultural conditioning, and culture is part of where we live and the reality of life. She talks about the fact that historically and traditionally in our part of the Western culture, the primary function of the family has been to provide economically. But that in our generation there has been a switch where the focus is coming to be primarily emotional support. So that where in the past a man and his family saw traditionally that most of what he was to do was be to provide shelter and clothing and food and security for his family, increasingly he must instead, or in addition, provide emotional caring and love and that type of security. So he needs to become an exceptional person able to do both. Or the woman needs to be the supermom who will provide not only economically but also emotionally within the home. But Curran goes on to explain that in our culture, that is a combination of expectations that are virtually impossible to fulfill. For it's both the old expectations and the new expectations calling upon us to do that which is superhuman. She adds to that cultural conditioning a second cause of stress, family stress, which she lists as suburban living. indicating that in America, where people used to live primarily in the cities, and contrary to what has happened in the rest of the world, where people have moved more and more to the inner city, Americans have moved more and more to suburbia. And with that, have added a huge number of functions to family life. So it includes things like sports and ballet and music lessons and clubs and school activities and church activities and neighborhood activities, particularly with parents increasingly pushing their children more and more into activities. At the same time, she says, parents have become increasingly spectators and decreasingly participants, no longer doing things with their children, but either sending their children or going to observe their children until calendars have become full, until they are out of control. She adds to that a third cause, which she labels as perfectionism, that many of us feel that we have to be perfect at everything. Have to be the perfect spouse, have to be the perfect parents, have to have perfect kids, unwilling to admit to failure, unwilling to admit or allow defeat. We want absolutely everything and everyone to go and to do well, which, of course, you know, is impossible. And that there are some things that may not even be worth the effort to do particularly well. Now, you listen to all of that, and maybe you do as I do, whether consciously or unconsciously, you begin to rate yourself, and you begin to rate your family. And when you do that, your stress goes up with that, because it's stressful to hear those kinds of descriptions. And there are evocations of guilt just with the very idea of all of these things. Hey, we need to hear that all families have stress. Everyone. That as individuals and as families, we'd be dead if we didn't. But the question is, are we getting too much? And what can we do about it? Tonight, let's consider briefly 5 suggestions of things that we can do about the issue of stress, particularly as it impacts our families. Suggestion number 1 is to trust God. And I am sure that to some has to sound tremendously pious and super spiritual. And there may even be some who say, well, you know, you got to get the religious part in first, and then you get on to the really practical psychological stuff later on, and then we'll really get into the meat of it. But actually, the trusting of God is the most important aspect and most important suggestion of all. For when we really have faith for our family life in God and don't have all the confidence in ourselves, then we are well on our way to really managing stress in our individual lives and in our families. In John chapter 11, a familiar passage of Scripture, Jesus related to a family that he dearly loved, a family that was in the midst of severe sickness. And by the way, severe illness is one of the major, major contributors to family stress. Listen to what Jesus did. It's in John 11, verses 1 and following, that a certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. It was Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was ill. So the sisters sent to him, saying, "Lord, he whom you love is ill." But when Jesus heard it, he said, "This illness is not unto death, it is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified by means of it." Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus, so, because he loved them so much, so when he heard that he was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Now Jesus clearly didn't get uptight about it. As many times as I have read that chapter and read that verse, the more impressed I have become that Jesus did not rush off, because Jesus had a confidence that God could handle it. And here one of his best of friends was dying. It had to be one of the most stressful of situations that Bethany household ever had experienced. And yet Jesus seems so cool, so relaxed about it. That's because he had an inner conviction that God the Father really loved Lazarus, and that God the Father really cared for Lazarus, and that God the Father was ultimately responsible for him, and not Jesus. And it's just because he had that kind of trust that he didn't have to hurry. He didn't have to take everything into his own hands, and he did not have to become immediately responsible for everything that was to take place.
I read that and I seek to apply that to my own life and to my own family. To come to a genuine spiritual commitment of family and marriage to God. To admit that God cares more than I care. And to admit that God is the one who is ultimately and finally responsible. And to trust Him for the ultimate outcome of everything and not myself. Now, I suppose that that smacks of becoming irresponsible or lazy or saying, well, you know, if everybody took that attitude, then families would be destroyed. People wouldn't provide. People wouldn't do anything that they ought to. Now, that's not the case at all. For you see, biblical Christianity that is here described is a Christianity where we become stewards, Christian stewards accountable to God, rather than becoming frantic manipulators of our fellow family members. And I think all that's hard to do. I think it's hard to trust God. I think that most of us, particularly in our culture, have a tendency to want to control everything, to want to make everything come out as it should. But the place then to begin is to give our marriages to God and to give our jobs to God and to let God be the one who is ultimately responsible for our children and to trust Him with our families as we trust Him for our salvation. My goodness, if He can handle our salvation, surely He can handle our families. He can do it because He's trustworthy. I say that's hard to do because I know I'm a father and I'm a husband and I'm a son. And I find that I so desperately want what is best for my family that I need regular reminders and need to make regular commitments that God cares more for my wife and for my children and for my parents than ever I could possibly care for them. As Peter wrote in 1 Peter 5:7, that we cast all of our anxieties on Him because He really does care for us. A second suggestion is to choose to grow. Crises and stress, you know, they're inevitable. Some of our families are better at shielding those stresses from other people. We get rather professional at putting up shields and masks to hide all of the things that are there. But every family has its issues of communication and money and school and friends and sex and church and jealousies and all of those other things. The key question then isn't whether we'll have the stress or not, but the key question is what we'll do with the circumstances and what we'll do with the stress. And whether or not we will perceive all of this to be an enemy that brings disaster or an opportunity that brings growth. Let me just list as two examples. Great stress producers in many households. One is when a husband loses his job, and that can cause enormous stress. Only those who have experienced it or at least have been close to it perhaps can understand the tremendous strain on any family. Not to in any way minimize how difficult this is. At the same time, does that family then perceive of that as a disastrous time for tearing the fabric of the family apart? Or does that family perceive that as an opportunity to make the wagons circle and to put the family together and to trust God and to grow through that experience in a way that there couldn't possibly be that growth if that difficulty had not arisen? So much so that 5 and 10 and 20 and 30 years later, there will be a conversation that will take place between that husband and wife that will reflect back to that time, maybe that extended time of unemployment, and say, you know, that was the worst of times in all of our marriage together, and that was the best of times. For while we didn't have much and while the stresses and the strains were extraordinary, that was when we really learned to trust God, and that was when we were really drawn together as never we would have been in prosperity. Or another very stressful example is when families go through difficulties with adolescent rebellion. Perhaps then, as maybe no other quite parallel way, families can be pushed to their limit by problems that are faced by teenagers. Any kind of a combination of poor grades or angry words or wrong friends or illegal drugs or illicit sex or spiritual apathy. All the kinds of things that can be the heartbreakers for Christian dads and Christian moms. And yet, that is probably that family's greatest, greatest opportunity to demonstrate the power and the person of Jesus Christ. So much so that, again, maybe 5 and maybe 10 and maybe 20 years later, a then-grown adult child will say, "Dad, Mom, I love you, and I'm sorry for all of the things that happened back then, and I wish I could take back some of those words. But let me tell you that it was through those teenage years and the way you responded to me that I learned more about Jesus Christ than in all the sermons I have ever heard and all the Sunday school classes that I have ever attended." You see, the question is, will these kinds of stresses become opportunities for disaster or opportunities for growth? One couple describes it this way. "Marriages are not made in heaven, nor in bed, but in the way people respond to crises." I like that. Marriages are not made in heaven, nor in bed, but in the way people respond to crises. I want to read to you a true story of significant family stress. Now, his parents went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of the Passover. And when he was 12 years old, they went up according to custom. And when the feast was ended, as they were returning, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem. His parents did not know it, but supposing him to be in the company, they went a day's journey and they sought him among their kinsfolk and acquaintances. If you ever lost a child, you know the feelings that were felt. And when they did not find him, they returned to Jerusalem seeking him. After 3 days, they found him in the temple, sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. And all who heard him were amazed at his understanding and his answers. And when they saw him, they were astonished. And his mother said to him, "Son, why have you treated us so? Behold, your father and I have been looking for you anxiously." And he said to them, "How is it that you sought me? Did you not know that I must be about my father's house?" I'll tell you, that's loaded with multiple meanings. For Mary, and especially Joseph, heard those words. And Jesus clearly communicated that Joseph, whom everybody thought to be the father, was not in fact the father. All the stress and all the anguish that they had gone through in discovering that he was gone, and in the 3 days that they hunted through the city to find him, he seems to write off. And they did not understand the saying which he spoke to them. Family stress? Hey, I'll tell you, that's family stress. A lost youth and anxious parents and a strange explanation. All of that sounds to me like a whole lot of trouble, but listen to what happens to the epilogue to the story. "He went down with them and came to Nazareth and was obedient to them. And his mother kept all these things in her heart. And Jesus increased in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and man." It had to be one of the worst stresses that that holy family ever experienced. Far more stressful than anything that happened in Bethlehem or maybe even the trip to Egypt. But they took the stress as an opportunity, and they chose to grow. A third suggestion is to alter expectations. You see, stress is raised by high and unattainable expectations. We think that we have to try harder and harder in order to lower stress. You know how it works. There's stress at home because the house isn't the way it's supposed to look. And so we assume if we can keep the house absolutely perfect, then the stress will be less. Or there are poor grades for junior at school. So we assume that if we hire a tutor and bring the tutor in every day, where the house is a mess, and let the tutor go at it with junior, then the grades will get better and then that stress will go down. Or we think that we have stress at work and what we really need to do is take a night class and work towards another degree, and then by taking on that extra degree or that extra class, then we'll lower the stress at work. Or we think that our lives are not spiritually what they ought to be and we need to become more involved spiritually and in the life of the church, and when we do that, then we'll get our lives in order spiritually. And then we recognize at the same time that there are parts of our lives that are unraveling and we don't have the support that we need. So we need to find a support group and meet regularly with that support group so that we can fix up that part of our lives. And then we discover that we don't have enough information to do all of these things, so we need to read more books. And we're ashamed of the fact that we've read so little, so we buy more books and start to read the books. And then we need to listen to tapes, and we try to listen to the tapes while we're reading the books. And on and on and on it goes. And what we do is we add to the stress by raising the expectations higher and higher and higher. Maybe what we need to do, instead of raising the expectations, is lower the expectations. Instead of becoming higher in expectation, maybe we ought to do away with some of them altogether. To conclude that some of these things maybe really don't matter at all. Now, I think that's a very, very difficult thing to do. And I think that the pressures in our society mitigate against that. It's hard to say no. It's hard to not try to be perfect. It's hard to not try for the best of everything. But it's often better. Many families should make a commitment that they're not going to do one more thing. They're not going to add one more thing to everything they're doing unless they have one thing that they're going to do away with. You know, in politics, what we have now, what are called sunset laws, that a particular law, a particular activity has a termination date that's set, and we're not going to take that on indefinitely, but only temporarily. We need to recognize that busyness is no virtue. Now, I say that, and yet I'm as well aware as anyone of the tremendous pressures to just stay busy, busy, busy. Overcommitment is no grace. It's far more of a vice. There's an interesting biblical example, I think a classic biblical example, in Acts chapter 5, of a couple that raised their expectations until eventually it killed them. They are Ananias and Sapphira, and their story goes like this in Acts 5, that a man named Ananias, with his wife Sapphira, sold a piece of property, and with his wife's knowledge, he kept back some of the proceeds and brought only a part and laid it at the apostles' feet. But Peter said, "Ananias, why has Satan filled your heart to lie to the Holy Spirit and to keep back part of the proceeds of the land? While it remained unsold, did it not remain your own? And after it was sold, was it not at your disposal? How is it that you have contrived this deed in your heart? You see, you have not lied against men, but to God." When Ananias heard these words, he fell down and died, and great fear came upon all who heard of it. The young men rose and wrapped him up and carried him out and buried him. You see, they wanted everything. Ananias and Sapphira sold their property, and they wanted to keep the money. They had a high expectation financially. But they also wanted everyone in the Jerusalem church to think that they were generous and sacrificial givers. So they had two expectations that were so high that they were impossible to achieve. And Peter is very explicit. Why did you do this? You didn't have to do this. It was your property. You didn't have to impress everybody. You didn't have to expect this of yourself. And eventually it killed them. And I suspect that when we allow our expectations to grow higher and higher and to try to become more and more efficient in all the things that we try to do, that eventually it can kill us, right? Just kill them. I suppose the practical thing to do is suggest that we think of maybe two or three or four places that we could lower our expectations, to deliberately say, "I don't have to do that well here. Things don't have to go perfectly at this point." Think of what could really make a difference in terms of family stress, and at least attempt to lower the expectations, alter the expectations of one. Well, let's move on to a fourth suggestion, and that's to care for the physical. You see, stress is very much a physical concern. Those that distinguish between stress and burnout, words that maybe unfortunately are used interchangeably often, those who distinguish between the two indicate that burnout is primarily an emotional phenomenon, but it is stress that takes primarily a physical toll. Elijah was one of the most stressed out of Old Testament characters. You remember his story, I assume. The story in 1 Kings 18 and 19 of how he reached, I think, the apex of Old Testament miracles. He went up on Mount Carmel and had a confrontation between himself representing Yahweh and all of the prophets of Baal. And you remember it was a long, drawn-out affair where water was poured on the wood and question was raised about whether or not either side could spiritually call down fire from heaven, and the prophets of Baal wailed out their prayers, actually flagellated themselves, and kept hoping and hoping that the fire would catch, but of course it didn't. But then when Elijah prayed, the fire came down from heaven, a major miracle of the Old Testament. But condensed in that same period of time, it was not just that. He was the one who was God's agent praying that there be no rain, that drought come. And he was the one who was God's agent in the bringing of the rain, and the drought ended. He was the one who took on King Ahab and the entire kingdom, single-handed, just alone, by himself. He was the one who slaughtered personally 450 priests of Baal. One man was taking on the powers of the kingdom and the powers of Satan as well, and is overwhelmingly victorious. Stress. Good stress, but stress. And then in 1 Kings 19, this man who took on the army and the kingdom and all of the priests is threatened by the words of a woman named Jezebel. And that's all that it takes to turn Elijah, the great prophet and man of God, to become suicidal. Listen to what happened. It's told in 1 Kings 19, verses 4 through 8. That he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came, and he sat down under a broom tree, and he asked that he might die, saying, "It's enough now, O Lord, take away my life, for I'm no better than my fathers." And he lay down and slept under a broom tree, and behold, an angel touched him and said to him, "Arise and eat." And he looked, and behold, there was at his head a cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water. And he ate and he drank and he lay down again. And the angel of the Lord came again a second time and touched him and said, "Arise and eat, else the journey will be too great for you." And he arose and ate and drank and went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the Mount of God. You see, what Elijah needed wasn't a miracle. What Elijah needed was a good night's rest and a decent meal. Exercise and rest are primary therapies for stress. That we go to bed earlier, that we sleep longer and not listen to the cues that have been built into the memories of our minds and into our culture, that you can always get by on less sleep, you can always push yourself farther. To start a simple exercise program, to take a day off, to stay home more nights, to eat a balanced diet. All of those things that relate to the physical, because there's a strong connection between stress and the physical. Now, I know there are those who say, and I count myself among them, "I just don't have time." But that becomes a tragic and a foolish mistake. Because again, hurrying is no virtue. God has created us to be whole persons, and as whole persons, that includes the meeting of our physical needs. It may take any one of a number of expressions. Perhaps it's a Sunday afternoon nap, or maybe it's staying home on Saturday night, or having a weekly Sabbath, whether it be Saturday or Sunday or some other day. You know, the Hebrew word Sabbath means stop. And God programmed that in, that that's a necessity for us. Those of you that are good Old Testament students recall that God commanded that the people of Israel leave their ground fallow for 1 year in every seven. And agriculturists today would say there was an obvious good reason. They would wear out the soil if they kept farming it on and on. The soil needed an opportunity to rest and for renewal. But even though given that command, the people of Israel never did it. They just kept plowing and they just kept planting and they just kept harvesting. They never took the Sabbath year for the nation of Israel until eventually God intervened. And he took the whole nation, the entire country, away into captivity for a period of 70 years. And God said that if they wouldn't give the Sabbath to the land, he would give the Sabbath to the land, and gave the land 70 years of rest. Now, I think there's a tremendous parallel there to our lives and our stresses. For it's a simple truth that if we don't take the Sabbaths, if we don't get the rest, if we don't give opportunity for renewal and for regeneration, that eventually a whole hunk of time comes. Perhaps sickness, perhaps major malady, where all of the catching up then has to take place. You see, the individual or the family that will not take that Sabbath day, you know, won't exercise, won't rest, often will then be hit in a way that will make it come, but that's obviously not the best way. The best way is to care for the physical every day and every week as an ongoing responsibility of the handling of stress. Well, add to your list a fifth and a final suggestion, and that is to prioritize commitments. In Matthew chapter 14, Jesus was experiencing an extraordinarily stressful day. You know how the day began? The day began with a death, a totally unexpected death. A member of Jesus' family, his cousin — we don't think of him primarily in terms of the cousin-to-cousin relationship. We think of John the Baptist quite differently, but he was a cousin of Jesus, who that day, as a party favor to Herod's wife, had his head cut off. It was absurd. It was obscene. Jesus began the day by getting the news that his cousin, the prophet of God, John the Baptist, his friend, had been martyred. And then that day progressed, being an extraordinarily stressful day. Jesus, in the midst of that deep grief, then went and spent much of the day preaching, which of itself, let me tell you, is an exhausting and a draining exercise. And then to that, he added the healing of all kinds of people. And then, miraculously, he provided for the feeding of 5,000 plus. And the crowds were pressing around him in this stressful day. They wanted more healing because, you know, it's one thing if somebody else is healed, but if you're still sick, then somehow that doesn't quite count. And they wanted to be taught. It's one thing if somebody else's questions have been answered, but if yours remain unanswered. So they pressed in to be healed and taught and helped. But look at what Jesus did. Matthew 14, verses 22 and 23. The end of this stressful day. He made the disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he dismissed the crowds, the ones who wanted to be healed, the ones who wanted to be taught, the ones who wanted to be helped. And after he had dismissed the crowds, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. When evening came, he was there alone. You see, Jesus ordered his priorities. He knew his limits, and so he walked away from the stresses. He went to be alone. I think that's what we all need to do. When the stress is starting to tear our lives and our families apart, we need to take inventory. We need to say, yes, there are many, many good things that need to be done. But when we've reached our limits, we need to back off. We need to say, it can't all be done. So what's most important? We need perhaps literally to take a time inventory and see what is happening in terms of the hours that we have, the commitments that we have made, the places that we are going, the things that we're doing. You see, I'm not talking here about the extraordinary times. I'm not talking about the day after the automobile accident or when a family member has died or when there's some extraordinary, exceptional crisis. Talking here about the everyday life, for you see, what many of us have done is we have raised the stress level until we are constantly operating at something near maximum, near the peak. And then when the death or the unemployment or the exceptional difficulty comes along, we have no reserves. When we're already at the peak, we have no way of handling that exceptional circumstance. And so what we must do is so order our priorities that we bring that threshold down. And that means saying no, as well as choosing that to which we will say yes. And when we operate then at a lower threshold where we have prioritized our commitments, then when the death, then when the exaggeration, then when the difficult times or the wonderful times come, then we have the reserves and then we have the opportunity to ride the peak and then turn to the usual priorities. All of which is to say that Christian stress management is not something that is done quickly or finally. It's not something that's done and then we're finished and we go on with the rest of life. It's a way of life. And so what I perceive we must do, individually and particularly as families, is to begin by trusting God, choosing to grow, altering our expectations, caring for the physical, prioritizing our commitments. May God bless you and unstress you.